Okay. I mean, when one looks at quantum foundations, it's very easy to become quite overwhelmed by the variety of different approaches that people take in their exploration of quantum theory. You've heard a lot about different interpretations of quantum theory. You've heard about non-locality, no non-contextuality. You've heard about a lot of these things, but we still say that we don't understand quantum theory. So what's missing? And in this lecture, what I'm going to try to do is give you a basic framework which will help pinpoint what is it that we lack and hopefully give a clear indication of what's needed. Now, the methodology is going to be to look at classical physics. It's something that we say that we do understand. Okay, so let's look at what we do understand and see if we can identify what is it about classical physics that makes it seem understandable to us. And what I'm going to sort of argue is that that classical physics has a very special sort of threefold structure which makes it comprehensible to us. The first is that classical physics comes with a very clear conception of physical reality, the mechanical conception of reality that was forged by Descartes, Galileo, and Newton, amongst others. So this is a very clear conception of reality. So And when this conception of reality is mathematized, quite naturally, it gives rise to what I'm going to call the classical modeling framework. And I'll explain what that is in detail in a moment, but essentially the classical modeling framework is a mathematical framework, a kind of a general purpose shell, okay, and for all classical physical theories. And we can, by putting specific content into this shell, we create a specific physical theory. So, for example, Newtonian mechanics. And in order to actually get the specific content, we put in some input here from experimental observation. And some theoretical, sort of physical ideas. And ideally, these are clearly rooted, the physical ideas are clearly rooted in somehow a conception of physical reality as well. So let's try to just make this a little bit more specific, a bit more concrete. First of all, what we mean by the mechanical view of reality. The essential intuition is simply that the universe is a vast machine, and a lot follows from that if we assume that the universe is rationally understandable. Of course, now what rational is depends on what culture you're from and what period in history you're from. And the Greeks found what we call irrational numbers irrational, which is why they call them that. We find them quite understandable. So what is rational is very relative, is very culturally dependent, culturally dependent. But certainly of the time of Descartes and Galileo, it was what rationally understandable meant in part is that the universe follows quantitative laws, not just laws which are comprehensible conceptually, but quantitatively precise laws, and that these can be formulated in principle and we can comprehend them. So what they were really aiming at, you know, obviously they have some specific thing in mind. They're thinking of things like planetary motion. They're thinking of the motion of projectiles, things like that. They wanted to mathematize the physical world. They wanted to think of bodies in motion in the Euclidean space following eternal laws of motion. This is the basic idea. And if you have a vast machine, the most natural assumption is to say that it obeys rules which apply everywhere and at all times. So you have this principle of the uniformity of nature. And if this machine has been created, it could be that it's rationally understandable from the sort of God's eye perspective, but it may not be the case that we as human beings or we as agents in the universe can come to know those laws. So we need some sort of assumption, which I've called decomposability. That is, it is possible for us to get to know what these rules are by isolating parts of the universe and just investigating them as they are, and treating that part of the universe to be quasi-isolated or quasi-enclosed. And then there are a whole bunch of very specific statements that we can make. And I don't want to overwhelm you with detail, but I mean, I just mentioned a few of these basic thoughts. I mean, you're familiar with the idea of that there's a universal time, which again suggests, comes from the idea that we're dealing with this vast machine and everything in the machine is moving in step with everything else, everywhere else. So there's some kind of universal clock that everything is following. And we have the idea of a state and some kind of intrinsic parameters, which are things like masses of particles, and a law of motion, which has the property of being, which determines the state. So you have a state at some time, which state determines a state at any later time, and vice versa. The later state determines the previous state. And then measurements can be used to. Right. Right. I'm not sure what to do. Okay. So measurements outcomes are determined by the state, and it's possible to do measurements on a system, on the universe, and the results of the measurements are reproducible. Okay, so that's very important if you want to do any experiments. You want to be able to do a measurement which tells you about the state of the system, and then you want to be able to therefore know what the state is immediately after the measurement. And if the measurement isn't reproducible, you can't do that. Okay. And finally, that this is a very important idea, the idea that there exists a measurement which tells you exactly what the state is. It actually pinpoints the state. So basically the idea is that you've got this vast machine, it's comprehensible quantitatively, following quantitative rules, and in principle we can access every minute detail of it. And we can directly mathematize these assumptions in the following way. We represent time with a real parameter, a state by some mathematical object S, which is a set of real numbers. And you've got dynamics represented by a one-to-one map over state space. So if this is your state space, then a state is represented by something here. And dynamics are represented by a map from state space to itself. And this map is reversible. So you can go from here to here or from here to here. And a measurement is simply a map from state space to real numbers or to Rn. Okay, so you can think of that as like measurements of position, measurements of velocity, and so on. And finally, the assumption of transparency is that there really is a measurement that we can do, which tells us exactly what state we're in. That's basically what we're saying. So I'm presenting something which is actually conceptually very simple, just in a slightly more abstract language, and you'll see the point of this as I go on. That this is something, in a sense, it's so obvious that we don't normally think about it, but it lies at the heart of classical physics. It's a general framework. Now, to give that content, you have to, look at some experimental situations, some experimental observations. So here's Newtonian mechanics written out in this framework. It's very simple. You write down the state in terms of the positions and velocities of n particles. Your mapping from state space to itself is just obtained by using the definitions of velocity and F equals ma. And so I just wanted to show you that you can actually write down Newtonian mechanics in this form. And in Newton's picture, I mean, so in giving specific content, putting specific content in here, he introduces a number of new ideas, the idea of instantaneous velocity, the idea of inertia, the idea of force. So all of these things are new concepts, which are kind of become part of our conception of physical reality, of Newtonian mechanical reality. And each of them, well, some are more controversial than others, for example, instantaneous velocity. But the concept of inertia is very intuitive, the idea of the sheer difficulty we have in getting something to go. And the idea of force, again, which is very intuitive based on our everyday experience of pushing on objects and so on. So some of the concepts he's using are just mathematized formalizations of everyday intuitive notions. So now let's look at quantum theory. What about quantum theory?
Sorry, yeah. Off in all those, and I don't know if they should.
Oh, that's why they told you that they can't hear. Okay, now we can see them, but they cannot hear.
Yeah, they can't hear anything.
Okay.
I mean, for example, this will be recorded on Pearson, so we'll have a chance to watch it anyway. It's a pity. So let's look at quantum theory and try to see, well, what I'm going to try to do is basically try to see, okay, this is Newtonian, this is the classical physics, how does quantum theory compare with this? And one of the comments I want to make is that, and I don't want to give the impression that this came first and then this and this in a very strict sort of historical order. That's not the case at all. But I would say that all of these kind of were co-present and becoming more and more sharp over time. And if you look at Descartes, who has already got a very mechanical conception of reality, so trying to explain planetary motion in terms of vortices, you already had this notion. And this concept of state and the concept of dynamics became gradually more clear over time. So I don't want to give the impression this must be the sequence history progresses in. I mean, it could be you start here and you go downwards. But this is what we would want, finally, I would say, if we were to really say we understand the physical theory. So when we say we understand quantum mechanics, I'm saying it's resting on these two more fundamental levels. So,
well, you know, we can hear you now.
Great, good news, thank you. Okay, so let's look at quantum theory. And I think it's very good just here to take a slightly historical view of it. Now, you all know about Schrödinger's mechanics, and I hope you're all familiar to some degree with the kind of reasoning that led him to his wave equation based on this idea of wave-particle duality of de Broglie, and Schrödinger's equation being kind of a precise expression of that. As you, I hope, also are aware that there is no, Schrödinger gave no derivation in sense of a strict logical development which led to his equation. It was actually essentially taking a classical equation, a classical wave equation, and then de Broglie's hypothesis, and making some very interesting mathematical guesswork, and actually arriving at his equation. And in one of the homework problems I for this lecture, I lead you through a heuristic derivation of Schrödinger's equation that I hope will give you a sense of just how many assumptions that he had to make along the way and how much uncertainty that leaves in its wake as to the meaning of the mathematics. So let's be a bit more specific here. I mean, so it introduced many non-classical features, which you're all familiar with, the statistical nature of measurement outcomes and complementarity. And it also introduced mathematical features whose, like complex numbers, which he was not able to give any kind of physical meaning to. These features, when you work through this homework problem, you'll see that complex numbers are somewhat forced on you in order to be able to write down the simplest equation that you can, wave equation that satisfies or reproduces the relationship that we want between the wavelength and the frequency of the wave. So they're very much forced on you. And worse than that, some of the key interpretations of the mathematics was given after the equation was written down. So Schrödinger, when he wrote down the equation, had this idea of a wave, a classical wave, something you can conceive of classically. But it turned out that's not an interpretation that can be maintained. You'll see that most obviously when you go to two particles, when you try to write down a Schrödinger equation for two particles, then you can no longer maintain the idea that psi represents some kind of disturbance in space. You can't have that interpretation. So this came out sort of post hoc. After the equation was written down, you realize, no, I can't maintain this idea of a classical wave. It's not a classical wave. It's something more abstract. So all of this came out afterwards. And this interpretation of that you all know that the psi mod psi squared as being the probability density of the probability density of finding a particle in a given place in space, this came out only later. And this is something very important indeed, I shouldn't neglect this, which is that the Schrödinger equation in its very formulation presupposes the existence of the classical world in its very formulation. So what do I mean by that? I mean, what it's saying is that here's an electron, classically. It's saying, well, no, we can't think of that as a particle in the ordinary sense. We can't use Newton's laws of motion. What we should be doing is using this wave equation, okay? But then it's saying that it talks about doing measurements on the particle and getting definite outcomes with certain probabilities. And that's classical thinking, that's classical language. So he's using that explicit classical language in the very expression of the theory. So that's somewhat troubling, and we'll see where that leads us a little bit later on. So the next step in the sort of the next point in the historical development. So I'll just write down Schrödinger's mechanics here. The next step was to basically take the very specific equations, the very specific mathematical structure that Schrödinger and Heisenberg came up with. Remember, this is meant to be a replacement for non-relativistic Newtonian mechanics. It's a very specific theory. It basically corresponds to Newtonian mechanics up there. Okay, so what we would like is a general abstract mathematical framework which we could use for constructing quantum theories of whatever we want, relativistic particles, electromagnetic field, and other things. Okay, so this was recognized very clearly early on that what we need to do is to look at Schrödinger's mechanics and extract the bare bones, the essential mathematical structure, which could take the role of the classical framework. So what we would want is something analogous to the classical modeling framework. And this was essentially achieved by Dirac and by von Neumann. And I'm not sure, I don't think that, I think that some of you are certainly not familiar with this. Could I have a rough show of hands of how many people don't know what I'm talking about when I talk about this? Okay, thanks. So let me just very, very briefly explain it. It's actually very straightforward. So the idea here is that, okay, so Schrödinger's talking about states as some psi over, let's say, x, y, z, and time. And he's got a very definite equation for the dynamics, which I'll just write the Schrödinger equation. And he has a very definite prescription for measurement of position, for example. We just look at that. That gives you probability density over x, and you've got a similar expression for momentum measurement. So that's kind of the Schrödinger picture. So in this more general framework, a state is represented by a vector in a complex n-dimensional vector space, for a finite dimensional system or an infinite dimensional complex vector space, which we call Hilbert space. The reason I make this distinction is this is very transparent mathematically. This, before you start talking about infinite dimensional vector spaces, you have to be very careful about what you mean by that to so that the mathematics behaves well. But for our purposes, it's just keep this in mind. It's very understandable. So it's just saying that we have a complex vector, okay? And so dynamics are given by unitary transformations. So we have basically U where, right. Just to give you some intuition in case this is again a little bit unfamiliar, a unitary transformation is roughly analogous to a rotation in real vector spaces. So what this is, a unitary transformation in the complex vector space preserves the length of your vectors. So it doesn't change their length, just like rotation. And it doesn't change the angle between two vectors. So it kind of behaves like a rotation. So as you can see, this is a very general statement now. It's not saying anything specific. There's no specificity here. And in particular, we're told that the unitary transformation that represents an evolution between time t and time t plus delta t has a particular form. Now, if this, I mean, I'm starting to get quite technical here. If this is not familiar, don't worry. Try to take away the idea that we can abstract away some of the details here. So we're not talking about Schrodinger's equations now. We're talking about unitary transformations. And this is now a very general thing. This can now apply to spin half particles. It can apply to all sorts of different physical systems. And finally, we need to talk about measurement. So a measurement in this framework basically requires you to give an orthonormal basis in your vector space. So again, just going back to three dimensions, you can specify all manner of different orthonormal bases. Okay, and what this measurement rule says is that if you have a vector in your space, you just look at the projections onto the bases, and you take that number and take the mod square of it. And that tells you the probability that your measurement will give you this outcome, or this outcome. Okay, so basically you can think of a measurement as specified by an orthonormal basis. So these are unit vectors which are orthonormal with corresponding outcome values, real values. And you can kind of crunch these, you can kind of encode both of these sets into one object, a Hermitian operator. So I'll just briefly, just for completeness, say that so you can crunch them together. Okay, so it's just a convenient mathematical representation of this. And from this, you can reconstruct that. So don't worry about this as if this looks kind of unusual. This is the essential idea, okay? So you can see this is a very general mathematical structure we have now. Can I ask if there are any questions at this point? All right, so where are we then? I hope you can see from this that we're carrying across many of the problems or uncertainties we had at this level. Here we have a state given, which is a complex thing, a complex object. Here we have complex vector spaces. And this idea of unitary transformations is an abstraction from this level here. And the fact that measurements are probabilistic and are obtained in this manner, you have a corresponding rule down here. So, and the most important thing, well, for many interpretations, is that here we've talked about the state of a particular system. So we've got the idea that we have some particle, and then it's immersed in some kind of environment. Think of an electron in an electromagnetic field. So when we're dealing with Schrödinger's equation, you would describe the electron according to the quantum prescription, but the environment of the particle you would treat using classical Maxwell's equations if you write down Schrödinger's equation. So there's this very strong cut, very strong separation between the system on the one hand and the environment, and also the measurement device. The measurement device, as I said, is being conceived of in a classical way. It generates outcomes which are definite that we can observe, which is a very classical idea. And all of that is carried forward in the quantum modeling framework. You don't lose that. So this quantum modeling framework, this is not the state of the universe. This is the state of a system. And the measurement is presupposing this classical thing here, classical outputs. And that's actually quite different from the situation we had in the classical world over there, where we're talking about the whole universe being a great big machine following certain universal laws. And when we go to this level and start talking about systems, that's very much our choice. We choose to do that. We need to do that, but it's very much a conventional choice. It's not something that's necessary. Here it seems to be built into the quantum modeling framework that there is this cut between the system, which is treated in a quantum mechanical way, and the background environment of the system, which is treated classically, and the measurement apparatus, which is described classically or spoken about classically. So, okay, reflecting now, what is it that we lack? We lack this. What we would like is a conception of physical reality, which, when mathematized, gives us this. And I didn't mention this, but to get from here to here, there is some more ad hocery, some mathematical ad hoc steps we need to get from here to here, which is not very important, but just some of you might be aware of that, that you have these Poisson bracket commutation relations, and you need those to actually get from here to Schrödinger's mechanics. But don't worry about that. The key point is that we don't have this conception of physical reality, which, when mathematized, gives us this quantum modeling framework. And quite apart from that, we don't understand why the state must be complex. I mean, in a classical framework, we had the idea the state is just a set of real numbers. So why is it that this framework is being so insistent that the state must be complex? Why is it pairing up numbers? Why is it pairing up real numbers in this very particular mathematical way? I mean, that's structure, which we don't understand. And dynamics here are saying, well, that they're unitary. But why does it have to be unitary? Unitary maps are one-to-one maps, so we understand that. But there are many one-to-one maps which are not unitary. Just to give you a visualization of this, if you think about it in real space, I said unitary transformations, you can think of them as rotations in real space. Well, what this is saying is that transformations can only be rotations of a sphere. I mean, just an intuition here. Well, you can do all sorts of things with a sphere apart from rotate it. You can imagine distorting the surface of a sphere in all kinds of ways, which could be reversed, right? You imagine the differential rotation of Saturn or something like that. Okay, it's rotating at different rates at different latitudes. You can imagine all kinds of mathematical maps, which are one-to-one but not unitary. So this is a big assumption, a big mathematical constraint, and it arises, you know, by doing this abstraction process from Schrödinger's mechanics. Okay, so we don't really understand that. Well, we don't understand it. And the second specific point is that when the quantum modeling framework is stated, it presupposes the classical world of definiteness in its very formulation. And that is also something that's very puzzling because, well, it seems that the way we describe, so when we describe reality, for example, if I have an electron and a proton, I can regard the electron as the quantum thing, and it happens to be the potential generated by a proton, and I treat the potential and the proton in a classical way. That would be one way of doing it. But equally, I could take the proton, the electron and the proton, and treat that as a quantum object. And now there's a possibility, for example, of entanglement between them. And that's a different physical, that will give you different physical predictions. So it's not entirely innocent where we make the cut between quantum and classical. And when we start talking about trying to extend this kind of thinking to the universe as a whole and say, well, you know, forget about the background, let us talk about the wave function of the universe. And then we're in trouble because what does measurement mean? And Owen Moroney has talked about this to you in the first four lectures. So it's a real problem, this presupp, and this is something that Bohr and others very early on commented upon. It's very, very strange to have a physical theory that we regard as a fundamental replacement of classical physics that requires and presupposes the classical world in its very, very statement. So, obstacles that stand in our way to a complete understanding, this is more or less just restating what I just said. We want a clear conception of reality, ideally so clear that when mathematized, it naturally leads to the quantum modeling framework. And what I'm trying to say here is that one of the main obstacles to actually formulating such a conception is that we don't really understand what this is saying about reality. There are certain things that we can read off, right? It's saying that state is given by a set of real numbers, dynamics are one-to-one, it's saying that measurement outcomes are probabilistic in nature, and that we have the phenomenon of complementarity. Okay, that's all very well. But the mathematics is saying a lot more than that. We have complex numbers and unitary transformations. What do they mean physically, right? If we knew what those meant physically, we'd have much sort of bigger target to shoot for. Do you see what I'm getting at here? That it would be really helpful to, okay, another way of expressing it is that the content of this mathematics is not fully conceptually accessible to us. Okay, if we want to philosophize about what this actually means conceptually, we better have a full access to the conceptual content of it, but we don't have that. So this is one of the big problems. We don't have conceptual access to the full mathematical content of the framework. And this situation I talked about with the presupposition of the classical world, we don't really understand that very well. Is it necessary? Is it not necessary? Is it possible to think about the universe, the wave function of the universe? Does that make sense? Is it possible to understand the quantum modeling framework without thinking about measurements explicitly? These are very difficult questions. And then finally, there's the sheer, I mean, even if we did know what all of this mathematics meant, there's the sheer difficulty of thinking about reality, forming a conception of reality that makes sense of all of this, which is a philosophical challenge. So what we have now is potentially, we can turn this around and turn this into a program, okay, a wish list, the things that we would like that will help us forward. So one of the basic things is, what physical ideas underpin this modeling framework? Okay, to put it another way, could we formulate a set of physical assumptions, ideas, and derive this mathematics? And that's what I'm calling a reconstruction, quantum theory. If we could do that, then we would have a much better, we'd have much more to shoot for here at this level. The second thing is that to help us form this conception, it would be very helpful to have a good idea about what the quantum world looks like. The way I like to think about it is that, imagine that you're walking along the street and, well, you've been dropped into an alien city and you encounter some structure in front of you. And you see it has, you're an alien, okay? So you see doors and you see things which we call windows and chimneys and roofs and walls. But you have no idea what this is for. You've got no idea what this structure is for, okay? You just have to take that as a given. You don't know what this is for. So you're trying to form a single conception. If you could only understand what it's for, you could probably understand why it needs all of these separate features. Okay. So what you start doing is you start walking around the house, the structure. You start walking around the back of it, and you see what we call a garden, and you go inside, and you see these partitions, and you see these internal doors, and you see all sorts of things. The more you see, the better chance you have of something going click, and you realize this is a structure which is meant to maintain people or maintain beings in a pleasant environment and satisfies various needs that they have. So the problem we face with quantum theory is that, you know, it's very strange, it's very counterintuitive, but the more properties that we learn of it, like you've heard about non-locality and no non-contextuality, for example, the more you learn about it, the better chance you have of somehow something going click and you understand suddenly how this all fits together. Because the situation we're in with quantum theory is that we know that it has a number of non-classical properties, but we don't have a single conception of reality that ties them all together. We don't understand why it has to be no non-contextuality, why it should have the property of no non-contextuality and non-locality and statistical determinacy and complementarity. We don't understand why all those separate features must happen together. Okay, what we want is a single unifying perspective, and then we can say, of course I know why it must have all of those separate features. So that would be a real understanding. And the very last thing I've mentioned here is that we need the philosophical imagination. Just as in the example of the house, you need the imagination to think to come up with a conception that ties together all of these separate features. And for that purpose, we need the philosophical resources. And what I mean by that is we need knowledge of non-mechanical conceptions of reality, for example. I think that's very important. And one of the most interesting things in quantum foundations recently is that there are a number of people willing to come out and actually say that that's the case and actually study philosophical systems which put forward a very different conception of reality than the one we're familiar with. So that's very important in just stretching. We may not believe that stuff, but it stretches our minds. Stretches our imagination, it helps develop our philosophical imaginations. So that's what needs to be done, in my view. It's essentially remove the uncertainty about the physical meaning of the mathematics here, and really grapple with this idea of why or whether it's necessary to presuppose the classical world of definiteness in the formulation of this quantum modeling framework, and also to develop our philosophical imaginations so that we have some more options down here. And finally, learn as much as possible about what kind of properties the quantum world has, so it will stimulate us at this level. Okay, so in the last part of this lecture, I just want to sort of use what I've said as a kind of a way to create a map of the major types of work that have been done in quantum foundations. And the goal is, in each case, to sort of more clearly see what has this contributed to our understanding? How has it helped us overcome the obstacles I've talked about? And in what way hasn't it helped us? I think when looking at quantum foundations, it's, as I said at the very beginning, it's very easy to become kind of overwhelmed with the proofs, interpretations, reformulations. And it's difficult to know what's being assumed, what's really been achieved through the process, and what remains to be done. So I'm basically assuming that you've been to Owen Moroney's course here. So I'll be talking about things, and I'm not going to go through them quite quickly. But stop me if you want me to explain things in more detail. So the first thing I'll talk about is interpretations. And interpretations are, you know, when people think about quantum foundations, I think that's the number one thing you think about: Copenhagen interpretation, many worlds interpretation, and so on. So what interpretations do typically is they assume the mathematics at the quantum modeling framework level, or the Schrodinger mechanics level, and attempt to give some kind of understanding of some feature of the mathematics that we find puzzling. And for example, in the case of, I've just focused on one point here. I mean, the famous Copenhagen interpretation, one of the major objectives it has is to try to help us to come to terms with the fact that it presupposes the classical world, that quantum theory presupposes the classical world in its formulation. Bohr said that effectively it has to be like this because the world in which we live as experimenters communicating our experimental results is a world of definiteness. And if we're going to formulate a theory about this reality, whatever it happens to be, then there has to be something in that mathematical structure which connects with our world of definiteness. It can't be any other way. So in a sense, the Copenhagen interpretation, one of the things it tries to do is to try to sort of make it seem inevitable that it must be like that. And the many worlds interpretation, in a sense, tries to go in the exact opposite direction. It tries to say, well, let's really try to get away from the classical part of the quantum modeling framework. So as I was saying, the measurement is one thing. And the other thing is the background environment. So let's talk about the universe as a whole. Then it has no background. We've got rid of the background. And let's get rid of the idea of measurement and collapse. Does that make sense? And then they try to actually push that to the logical conclusion and see if it makes sense. One of the biggest problems is that it's saying that measurements should be treated as interactions. So you don't treat a measurement device as anything different from any other than an electron. So what, as you heard in the first few lectures of this course, you have the measurement problem. So you have a problem that in most cases, you don't get a clean outcome, this one or this one. You get basically a superposition of the two. You don't get a clean outcome. So somehow you have to deal with that. And in the many worlds picture, you have to deal with the idea of how can you possibly make sense of the idea that all possible outcomes actually occur, right? So that's the philosophical challenge they face. And they come up with a pretty interesting solution to that problem. And then you have the problem, well, how do you understand probability in a world where everything that's possible actually occurs? And they are the people who sort of push this interpretation argue that it still makes sense, and even that they're able to derive the mathematical form of the probability rules from some very reasonable assumptions. So that's the claim that they would make. So both of these interpretations, I think the major focus is this idea of classicality, this classicality assumption. One tries to defend it and maintain it's necessary. The other tries to dispense with it and argue that we can still make sense of the quantum modeling framework. I should say that, so sort of in this diagram, I would say that what's happening is that we're trying to connect together this level here. It's not really one way or two ways. It's really a two-way thing. We're trying to form a conception of reality. It's a very partial conception, okay? It's a very partial conception, and trying to interpret the mathematics in terms of that and see if it makes sense, see if we can make sense of it. What either of these interpretations doesn't do, it doesn't explain most of the mathematics of quantum theory. Most of the mathematics is presupposed in both interpretations. And that's very characteristic of interpretations. They take a whole lot for given, as given, and focus in typically on just a couple of points, which are key points in their view, and they try to find a way of understanding those points. So another approach to improve our understanding is to take the mathematics, either this mathematics or that mathematics, and rewrite it in some way. Basically turn it, mathematically recast it in a way that, as a result of the recasting, is somehow illuminating. Physically, it gives us a different intuition, a different sense about what the quantum world is like. And I've just mentioned a couple of them here. There's this Feynman path integral formulation, which I'm hoping that you're all familiar with in some sense. Can you tell me those who are not familiar with it? Okay. Very, very briefly, classically, you can think about dynamics in two ways, or at least two ways. There's the Newton way, to say that if I have a particle with a certain velocity at this point, it follows a certain trajectory because of Newton's equations of motions, which we integrate all the way along. Or you have another way of thinking, which is to say that you consider all possible paths between here and here, and the path that's followed is somehow special. There's some quantity associated with each path, some number. And the path that the particle really takes is the path which extremizes that quantity. So it's the idea of the path of least effort, or the path, in the case of photons, to take the path of least time. And what Feynman does is really pretty fascinating, pretty interesting. In the sense, what he does is to say, in quantum theory, what happens is that, let's suppose that this is the classical path. What Feynman says is that, well, actually, consider all possible paths. And associate a complex number with each of these paths. And he gives a prescription for doing that. And then what you do is you add all of those complex numbers together. He calls those complex numbers amplitudes. Add all of those amplitudes together, and then mod squared. And mod squared is the probability that the particle will be found here, given that it was here. So, and this has to be normalized. But basically, the idea is that the particle kind of, it sort of, the intuition is that it somehow sniffs out all paths going from here to here. In some sense, it goes along all of the possible paths. And so it's a very powerful way of thinking. And as I said, it presupposes this mathematics, but it does give a very different intuition and helps you helps you see what should happen qualitatively in many situations. The Bohm reformulation, what that essentially consists in is the first papers anyway, is rewriting the Schrödinger equation in a form which very closely resembles the classical equation of motion, which for an ensemble of particles called the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And historically, that was very important in foundations for many reasons, but one of the most striking is that the non-local interactions between separated systems becomes very, very clear in the mathematics. It's very, very transparent. And it directly inspired, I mean, Bell directly cites it as an inspiration, a major inspiration for his exploration of non-locality. Basically, the thing was, well, if in the math, this reformulation, you can see these non-local influences so clearly, well, you know, is there some way of proving that this is real influence of some kind that's non-locally propagating? Can you really prove that in some way? So, reformulations, I would say, sort of just very generally, what they do is they bring into focus, they provide a very specific perspective on the quantum world. And they bring certain features to our notice and other features drop into the background. And they help us to understand certain aspects of the quantum world, and particularly clearly. So that's one of the reasons that they're very valuable. I'll just go. So the third thing here is what I just simply call philosophical reflection, which is attempts to develop a philosophical understanding of the non-classical features of the quantum world. I mean, this began very, very early in the development of quantum theory. Bohr, Niels Bohr, Wolfgang Pauli, Heisenberg, Schrödinger all have written a significant amount about the philosophical implications of this. They're a very philosophical bunch. And just to give one of many examples, but Bohr developed a very general philosophical concept of complementarity. In other words, what he was trying to say is complementarity isn't just something that we see in physics, that we see in a quantum, our interaction with a quantum world. It is something that, it's actually something very, very general. And it's something that's a part of epistemology in a very general sense. So what he was trying to do is say, well, it's natural to expect the world to be like that to some degree. Okay, he wasn't being precise. He wasn't able to derive anything mathematically precise out of this, but he was able to make us feel somewhat comfortable with the idea of complementarity. And this is sort of reflecting philosophically about things that we find in quantum theory very directly. And I just give another example of a different kind. Heisenberg and Bohm both noticed that, believe it or not, notions that Aristotle introduced in classical Greek philosophy seem to have something to do with complementarity. And Aristotle introduced these concepts of potentiality and actuality in direct response to an argument that was given by a philosopher to say that change is impossible, that logically change is incomprehensible. And when one reads that debate and that discussion, it's philosophically, conceptually very acute, logically very acute. And it seems incredible that in philosophy over 2,000 years ago, people were led to think of these ideas, which I think bear a great similarity to some of the things that we find in quantum theory. And there are many other examples like this. And as I was saying earlier, one of the interesting things in quantum foundations is that a number of people now are saying quite seriously, look, if we're really going to understand quantum theory, we need to avail ourselves of the resources, philosophical resources, which are out there, and look around to see what's out there. We may be surprised. Okay, this is much of a quick... So here I'm talking about discovering properties of the quantum world. So one of the things I said is that when you look at the mathematics of the quantum modeling framework, there are things that you can just read off very easily, the idea of the statistical measurement outcomes. And complementarity, but as you know, there are other properties that have been discovered, like non-locality, and one of the very interesting things over the last sort of 15 to 20 years is that the development of quantum information and quantum computation has made people think about the quantum world very much in terms of information, in the sense of what kind of informational tasks are possible, right? Is it possible for me to clone a physical system? If you give me a quantum system in some state which I don't know, is it possible for me to put it into some sort of universal photocopier? Outcomes, the original and a copy, is it possible to do that? So they're thinking much more in informational terms about the quantum world. And that's led to some very interesting discoveries, like a proof of what's called the no-cloning theorem, which you'll hear about later on in the course. And this phenomenon of teleportation sounds like something out of Star Trek. What it means is that if you and I meet and we share something called a resource, an entangled pair of particles, and you get into a spaceship and go to a faraway galaxy, then we can use that resource in such a way that I can take some quantum system in some state, which I don't know, I don't need to know what that state is. I could do some operation locally on my half of the entangled pair, and I can communicate some information to you, two bits of classical information, and you can do something locally on your part of the entangled pair, and then you know that the particle that you have in front of you is in exactly the same state as the particle that I was trying to send to you. So I've somehow transmitted the state of a particle to you just with two bits of information, because we shared this entangled resource at the outset. Okay, and this is something that you'll get in a lot of detail in a week or two's time. So this is teleportation. And these things have been discovered, you know, just in the last 20 years or so. And there are many more besides, which have come out of quantum information theory and computing. So this is very helpful for developing our understanding, stimulating our imaginations. It shows us what some things that aren't possible, right? In the classical world, that is possible. In the quantum world, it can't. It can't be done. And teleportation. So it's quite stimulating to us. I should say that, you know, by themselves, it's just like the structure with windows and doors and roofs and walls and so on. Each of these is saying this structure has this property and this property and this property and this property. But that doesn't mean we understand how this all fits together. Okay, so we still lack that. But knowing all of this helps us form that conception. And one other kind of thing that's done is trying to actually modify the mathematics here. So not being content just to take it as is, but to actually modify it. And I think it's fair to say that the most direct motivation for that is to get rid of this idea of that measurement is basically when a measurement happens is very much dependent upon where we say it should, where we say it's happening. Okay, so the quantum formalism is at present the way it's formulated. It doesn't provide any guidance as to when a physical process should be treated as a measurement or when it should be treated as merely an interaction. And what people try to do is to modify the mathematics of quantum theory so that measurement happens intrinsically in the theory. It happens because of some physical process, and it's not something that happens when we think it, decide it should happen. Okay, and so, for example, Penrose has the idea that somehow it's actually gravity. It's actually gravity which actually brings about a collapse into one or the other possibility, and he gives a partially quantitative scheme which sort of predicts how fast that should happen. And there are kind of specific models like the GRW collapse model that you heard about already, which again try to do something similar. And you know, these sorts of things, the weakness about them is that we're trying to play around with the quantum formalism in a way that we don't really know what it means. We don't know what we don't know whether it's almost like you're going into a structure, a mathematical structure that's very well constructed, it's very tightly constructed, and you're going in and changing something. And it may be that that puts it into a state of disharmony. Maybe that's just not allowed. Maybe that just doesn't make any sense. So we're doing something that mathematically perhaps looks plausible, but it may actually be incoherent. So that's part of the problem about this type of approach. But nevertheless, this sort of approach, actually pushing it, does show us what may be possible in terms of modification of quantum theory. And finally, I'd just like to talk about reconstruction. I mentioned it briefly already. It's the idea of taking it's basically the idea of formulating a set of physical assumptions. Which are in some sense motivated by some conception of physical reality and deriving the quantum modeling framework from them. Okay, so that's the basic idea. What we would like is to replace all that abstract mathematics by a definite set of statements that we conceptually understand, that we understand what they mean as physical statements. And if we have that, then we can actually have a much better handle. We have much more to shoot for, basically, when we're trying to form a conception of reality. And I mean, I very, very crudely characterized reconstruction here. I mean, and people will maybe disagree with this, so this is very much my perspective on it. But pre-1980s, I think reconstruction was done in a very logical, very abstract mathematical way. And it didn't seem, as far as I can see, it didn't have that much impact on quantum foundations, on helping us really understand what the quantum formalism was saying. But in the period after the 1980s, starting, I think, was inspired a lot by Wheeler's ideas, which I'll talk about next time. There's this excitement amongst physicists, people involved in foundations, that it really may be possible to come up with a bunch of really quite simple physical ideas and actually derive the mathematics of quantum theory in a quite transparent way without a great deal of logical thinking, you know, logical structure, and without, you know, without heavy mathematics. So in a way that we could really get to the mathematics of quantum theory and really get some physical insight into it. So, in fact, this is what I'll be talking about next time, so I won't go into it in more detail now. So these are the key ways in which I haven't talked about everything that's done in quantum foundations, but I think I've probably mentioned, but I would say that about 90% of what's done in quantum foundations falls under one of these categories. And you can see that each of them has its strengths in terms of it tells us something, and its weaknesses as well. And I think it's very important to keep that in mind. So interpretation focuses typically only on specific aspects of the quantum modeling framework that we find difficult to understand. It helps us to understand those features, but it assumes, for example, the mathematics of the rest of the mathematics as a given. So I've talked now for a considerable time, and I'm very open to sort of a short discussion period where you can ask me any questions that you like about what I've spoken about.
Nobody's going to. I'll start out.
Great.
Just fine.
Right.
It seems as if in some of your formulations, which I enjoy hearing very much, you make some sort of presuppositions that could be dangerous, and I wonder if maybe you could talk a little bit about those and what you think about those. For example, when you talked about properties of the quantum world, using that phraseology seems to suggest that indeed, there is a quantum world, and it is the kind of thing that has properties. And one could dispute that, you know, or allegedly say there is no quantum world. So how, and nonetheless, those issues, like, you know, sort of no non-contextuality, no cloning, teleportation, I mean, these are practical issues that arise no matter what one happens to feel about whether there's a quantum world and whether it has properties or not. So. In some sense, the issues must survive your categorization.
Right. Yeah.
So, how maybe just say something that
about. It's difficult. One struggles with language here. What does one call non-cloning and the possibility of teleportation and no non-contextuality? I can call them features if that's some sort of more neutral language. I suppose. The underlying conception I have, indeed, is the idea that the analogy of a house is quite a good one. I mean, it has certain properties. It has an inside and an outside. It has walls. It has a roof, and so on. And I think that's quite, so that's the underlying thought, that we're probing some reality, which I'm calling the quantum world, but some reality, and I'm saying that it has certain properties.
I guess Bohr might argue that that's a wrong way to think of knowledge, right? That the mathematics is just a symbolical formalism, and it doesn't really refer to anything that's there in that sense.
I've never understood what he meant, I have to say. Yeah. Now, if you could elaborate on what you think that he might have meant, that may be helpful. I mean, in what sense could you talk about, if you say, well, there isn't a quantum world, then what does the mathematics refer to?
Well, I guess one might say, speaking for what maybe I think or they thought, that the mathematics are, it's a formalism. Mm-hmm. It helps you, predict the phenomena. And
right.
The phenomena are something you have to, at least with later Bohr, right? The phenomena are something you have to understand in terms of a whole experimental procedure and a very holistic kind of view of things and so on. Mm-hmm. But that the formalism doesn't sort of point to something that's actually there, and indeed, that kind of description is impossible in principle, because there really is no separation between subject and object, and all these classical presuppositions we have to make to be unambiguous in our communications are really wrong, and but we have to use them, and therefore the best one can do is a kind of a complementarity approach. That's the best way out. Mm-hmm. The way out of the conundrum that classical concepts are, that we have to use classical concepts, but quantum mechanics tells us that they're wrong. So that kind of a framework means, you know, well, you talk about things you can do, like teleportation and so on, but those are just like other tasks you can do, right? Bohr said, there is no measurement problem. You report the results of measurements, write them down in a book, and that's true whether you're doing quantum mechanics or classical mechanics. Right? So some features of the kind of language that occur naturally, I mean, occur naturally to you, and certainly occur naturally to me, don't seem to fit into that framework. And I guess my only point is that when you adopt that way of thinking, in some sense, you rule out that framework sort of implicitly, or you risk.
Sorry, you rule out which?
You rule out a sort of a bore kind of, you,
right.
You know, at least implicitly, you run the risk of it.
I suppose I interpret Bohr as saying that we should be very careful about talking about this reality as something in itself, as something independent of our investigations of it, and that we run into real trouble if we start thinking about it being a certain way independent of our existence, so to speak. So that's the sense in which I understand it. So I would always think of a property as a relational thing.
Okay.
So in the case of a house, I mean, you know, if I were equipped with infrared vision or X-ray vision, I would see something different. I would perhaps see things that I wouldn't see if I have my ordinary vision. So it's very much a feature, is something that comes into my awareness as some entity or something which holds together, has a certain substantiveness. So it's very much dependent upon the way I interact with things.
But that's a different way than property would appear in classical mechanics, or at least in one reading.
That's true.
Yeah. I've had my go. Does anybody else want to try?
Look, I was going to raise a question about something that you stressed right at the very beginning of your talk about what it is to understand the theory. Okay? And you mentioned two things that at first sight look as if they're obscuring quantum mechanics. I just wanted to pick up on those two things. Mm. One is, why is the state represented by a vector? And in particular, a complex vector. And the second thing was, why does that state evolve according to a unitary transformation? Okay? Now, in the first case, suppose I say to you, why in classical mechanics is the state represented by a combination of P and Q? Why isn't it just Q? Do we understand that? Well, it's just part of the theory. Once we understand the dynamics, we realize that the initial conditions, you have to specify not only the positions, but also the velocities. Now, I don't think there's any way of understanding that other than just by looking at the guts of the theory. So why not just say in quantum mechanics, it's part of the guts of quantum mechanics that the states are represented by complex vectors?
Right.
Okay, that's the first point I wanted to raise. The second one is just, well, why unitarity? Because you're assuming from the beginning, at least if you start with something like the Schrodinger formulation, that the state has a connection with probability. So you've got a psi squared representing a probability density. Now, if the state didn't evolve unitarily, the normalization of that probability would disappear. You really couldn't continue to apply a probabilistic interpretation. Isn't that an explanation of sorts?
Right. Okay, so the first one about the complex vector. I suppose the key thing is that in the classical framework, at the level of the classical modeling framework, so not talking about So what you were referring to is that the Newtonian mechanics level, that you have the P's and Q's. But at the classical modeling framework level, you just have a state being a series of sets, a set of real numbers, an ordered set of real numbers. So that itself is what I'm comparing to the situation at this level, where a vector isn't just a real vector, a vector of real numbers. It's a vector of complex numbers. So numbers are being paired together, number one, and they're being put in this very special complex form, which gives a certain algebraic structure to them as well. I mean, that's additional input, mathematical input. So I think that's something that needs to be explained. Why not just a real vector with two n dimensions? On the second thing about unitarity, I think, just again, the visualization of just looking at the real space. I mean, you could just look at, consider Rn, and consider the set of all unit vectors on the surface of the unit hypersphere in an n-dimensional space, a Euclidean space. Then unitary transformations correspond then to rotations of that sphere. So the thing is, you can conceive of transformations that preserve the length of vectors, but distort the sphere. I mean, you just imagine taking it and doing some sort of twist to it, or differential rotation. So there are things which are length preserving, which are normalization preserving, but which are not unitary.
Can you give an example?
Well, I gave the example. I mean, I think the example that sort of came to me when you look at, let's say, Jupiter or something, you have differential rotation, so that the rate of rotation depends on the latitude. So anything like that would preserve the length of any particular vector.
Wouldn't you lose superposition?
Well, see, then there are other issues, ramifications. But normally in a quantum modeling framework, that superposition principle isn't given as an independent assumption.
It's a linear vector space.
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean superposition?
Well, it depends on what your take is you've given. What I'm trying to say, consider what the most general structure would be. It would just be a set of real vectors and one-to-one maps. You can have them normalized if you want, but well, one-to-one maps.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, well, I don't want to hold you here for no more questions. I just say that the question sheets for this lecture, I looked on the website 2 hours ago and they weren't there yet. Now hopefully, if you look tomorrow, they will be. The overhead transparencies are now, should be on the website again tomorrow. And there will be another short question sheet for the next lecture, which I'll have on the website on Thursday. If you want to talk to me about anything, if you want to come here and discuss anything, just send me an email and arrange a time. Suggest a couple of times when you're free, and that will help.
So there's two separate question sheets?
Yes.